Sir, I urge you not to leave this room.
Excuse me.
Please.
Hunt is uniquely trained and highly motivated. A specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. There is no secret he cannot extract, no security he cannot breach, no person he cannot become. He has most likely anticipated this very conversation and is waiting to strike in whatever direction we move. Sir, Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny, and he has made you his mission.
Welcome to End Credits, the End Credits radio show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Jesse Malott.
And Jesse, our mission, should we choose to accept it, is to review the latest Tom Cruise movie, which is Mission Impossible Fallout. Do you accept?
I do.
Well, it's probably too late to ask now. Anyway, that's what we're coming up on the show. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new action movie that we just mentioned, Mission Impossible Fallout. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half of the show, we're going to talk about some... Well, we usually talk about some movie news from the past week, but since we, you know, have these previous five Mission Impossible movies that we can talk about, we thought we'd talk about those because, you know, it's incredible looking at a six-movie series that has spanned 22 years, several different directors, you know, it's same star, but I mean... Just different styles and tastes and different weird directions. And they also was like for a while there, it was like a director's showcase. It was like the one thing that the James Bond movies have never really been, which is like, we're going to hire really great directors. They're going to come in, put their stamp on the material because, it's all there in the blueprint where you get the mission and the self-destructs in 5 seconds and the masks and the music. And you know, so just you give... you give a director the same set of ingredients and you see what they can cook.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing I realized almost right away because I watched the first Mission Impossible like almost right when it came out. And I realized who was attached to him. I'm like, Brian De Palma, you mean the guy that did Scarface and The Untouchables and all those like really weird twisted movies like Carrie and even the one John Travolta movie from the early 80s, Blow It. I'm like, this guy is doing Mission Impossible.
Yeah, that's a good place to begin because, you know, when you look at the first Mission Impossible, which came out in 96, it's very atypical of the action movies of the time. And it's, you know, when it came out, I was in high school, but I wasn't so much of a film geek yet that I didn't know. Like, I knew what movies Brian De Palma did, but I was not familiar with them yet. But it's funny, you know, understanding Brian De Palma's career now and seeing what makes the first Mission Impossible different, which is it's a film noir. It's not a spy movie. It's not an action movie in terms of, and it's not even a movie in how we've come to understand the Mission Impossible movies. But it's very Hitchcockian inspired, very film noir, like very De Palma sensibilities, and it's not it's not like any other action movie that came out in like the couple of years before.
Yeah, it's a psychological sexual drama, and like that's what Brian De Palma's known for, and like as I said, I was in high school as well, and like I had been well aware of him, and I think at that point I had seen Scarface. I know I'd seen The Untouchables, and I knew he did Carrie, but I don't think I'd seen Carrie yet. I did see the blowout movie with John Travolta, which is fantastic, and it's one of John Travolta's lesser known movies, but that too is a psychological sexual drama.
Yeah, it's right on the edge of like after after Travolta did, like...
Urban Cowboy.
Yeah, so, like, his Grease, Urban Cowboy, like, when he was a hot commodity, before he, like, teetered off into the 10 years of relative obscurity before Pulp Fiction, like, the Look Who's Talking movies, that era of John Travolta. It's so unusual, there is the big action piece at the end where Tom Cruise is on top of the, well, not literally, I think that's pretty clearly visual effects and green screen, that he's not actually riding the top of the Chunnel train, although if they made it today, he would definitely be on top of the Chunnel train.
Yeah.
But the main centerpiece of the film is that break-in into the CIA vault where he's dangling from the ceiling and you can't touch the floor because that sets off the alarm, and you can't sweat because it'll increase the atmosphere in the room a degree and that will set off the alarm. And it's just this elaborate piece that's all about him being dangled from the ceiling to download something onto a CD-ROM. And
I know, and when you think about it nowadays with how technology has increased, it's like, you wouldn't need to do that.
Yeah.
You could just, like, crack it. You could just, like, easily find some tech genius who could probably, like, crack their security.
It's the internet, like, the way that the internet is in that movie, it's so funny now looking back. I mean, I'm sure it was all fairly technical and new and inspired, but at the time, when you're, like, seeing him, like, use Alta Vista and use net groups to find, you know, the link with like Job and, you know, Bible verses and things, it's really quite bizarre and not how we understand the internet at all. But it's such a fun movie. And De Palma, like, it enjoys the gamesmanship of, like, I think what sets Mission Impossible apart. I remember, I'm old enough to remember watching Mission Impossible when they did, like, a reboot in the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember watching that. I don't remember, like, specific episodes, but I remember watching that. I was on Thursday nights, I think. But what made it unique, at least to me, was, like, it's, you know, it's as much like a con game as it is, like, a spy thing. You know, most spy things turn, you know, come down to, you know, shootouts, or, you know, when you think of spy stuff, you think of James Bond, but in the Mission Impossibles, it's, you know, it's all about, you know, pretending to be someone and slipping in and, you know, pulling a switcheroo and, you know, the light touch. And so I think Brian De Palma understood that very well. And I think the films have also come around to being able to balance big action, Tom Cruise's need to, you know, overcome a fear of death, I think, and while understanding it, it's also fun to just watch, you know, the game unfold and to watch people be sneaky and to watch, you know, having to palm things. And it's, you know, I think that's what makes this series unique.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I absolutely love movies with elaborate plots where they don't actually, you know, that's actually the one major criticism when the first one came out. They're just like, we don't understand the plot. We don't understand what's going on. It's like, yeah. And what's the problem?
Well, I think that comes from the scene, where Ethan Hunt encounters Jim Phelps. Jim Phelps, who of course was the main character in the, in the old Mission Impossible series, but played by a different actor, as Peter Graves on the show, John Voight in the film. This is after he thinks Jim Phelps is dead, and he's going over the scenario of how his team was killed, and people are like, is this real? Like, is he imagining this? And there's the one part where he imagines how one particular member of the team is killed, and it's this woman who's Jim Phelps's wife, but Ethan obviously has a thing for her, played by Emmanuel Baird.
Yeah.
And he sees her killing the one member of the team, and he's like, no, it had to be something else.
Yeah. And I realized that was a dream sequence when I saw it.
But it's so wonderful because it is a dream sequence, but it's also like a flashback, and you have to question how much is what.
Right.
And because it's Ethan putting the pieces together. And if you're not, granted, used to, again, it comes down to the style of the action movies at the time. it didn't leave you with a lot of thinking. Like, there's no, like, real intricacies to, like, executive decision or Bad Boys. Yeah. You know, there's no scene where Steven Seagal's putting it all together. and out for justice or something or whatever. I want to get into Mission Impossible 2 because I think it's the I don't want to say it's the worst Mission Impossible film, but I think it's the least of the Mission Impossible films. Because I think the best Mission Impossible film is still, or the worst Mission Impossible film is still better than, like, the best Expendables film.
Mm.
But I admit I kind of bought into the myth of it's terrible. You know, looking back on it, it's terrible. And then Screen Crush published an article that's like, no, 5 reasons why Mission Impossible 2 is actually awesome. And I have to admit, I was kind of persuaded. I mean, it's still the least of the series, but it's not as bad as I think people remember.
Well, the one thing that actually stands out to me about Mission Impossible, aside from the fact that John Woo, as far as I can tell, and from everything that I've read, is that he had literally no control in the director's cut. And I think actually that might actually be the case across the board, where no director actually has the final cut. I think Tom Cruise may have the final cut. It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But the other thing that actually stands out is due to the guy that played the villain in Mission Impossible 2, Gregory Scott, was initially supposed to play Logan in X-Men.
Like
who knows who that guy is today? As opposed to, I don't know, some random Aussie actor who wound up playing Wolverine.
I wonder if, like, Hugh Jackman sends him, like, a basket of muffins every year, like, on the anniversary of him getting the call.
Yeah, I know.
It's like, dear Dougray, thanks for everything. Hugh. I mean, that's the legendary bit of that movie. This is really, like, peak John Woo, though. Mm. This came out, like, right after Face Off. So he was still kind of largely unknown to American audience, but it plays into a lot of, John Woo's, quirks, like, things about dual identity and, because the villain played by Scott is himself an IMF agent, so there's betrayal and, this police, basically a world police force, corruption in the ranks. And then, of course, there's, all the... I think I call it like peak aughts with like the fashions and the hard metal soundtrack and the leather jackets and everyone in sunglasses and Ving Rhames' character Luther, like every 10 minutes he's like complaining about his like designer clothes. He's in a gunfight at one point and he's like, he put a hole in my Versace. How dare, it's so bizarre, like just the name dropping of what I'm wearing. I think that's part of what makes it enjoyable. Tandy Newton's in this.
Oh, right.
And I think this is a great showcase for her.
Well, and not only that, Tom Cruise worked with her before. She was very, very briefly in Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Like, she's only in Interview with a Vampire for like 5 or 10 minutes, not even.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they might have known each other. He might have referred her. And that was after she became big with, I think it was the Demi film, Beloved. That was what blew her up. She's really great in this. And Anthony Hopkins, I think, is like maybe the best IMF boss that we've never seen again, because he's just, he's clearly just having a good time, like ordering Tom Cruise around. I guess like it's so funny when it was in the trailer and everything. But when Ethan Hunt says to him, it's like it's going to be difficult, and Anthony Hopkins goes, "Well, this isn't Mission Difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's Mission Impossible." Difficult should be a walk in the park. And it's such a great line, and Anthony Hopkins like delivers it with like glint in his eye, and he's like, yeah, you go and do that job, Tom Cruise. It's just fun. I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, because it's been a while since I've seen Mission Impossible 2, but I just remember it being like, in comparison to the first one, being very, very hammy in terms of acting.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Like there's like portions where Dougray Scott is like chewing on the scenery.
Yeah.
And he has like this bizarre relationship with like one of his lackeys.
Mm.
And that's actually one of my favorite scenes in the film, is when the final fight, when Ethan Hunt posing as the lackey, brings the lackey in all tied up, but with an Ethan Hunt mask on, and Duke Grey Scott ends up killing Ethan Hunt, not realizing he's killed his lackey. Well, Ethan Hunt gets away with, like, this killer virus that he's trying to buy. And, like, Duke Grey Scott's, like, primal scream when he finds out it's his lackey. It's almost too beautiful to be allowed. I love that sequence, the way it was edited, and the Hans Zimmer music. And like I said, it's peak John Woo. It's peak aughts. It's, the whole thing with, it was before 9/11. So that's why it's like, we need something for the spies to be doing. So the go-to was always a killer virus for some reason. So, it's not without its charms, I want to say, which brings us to Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah.
Which, I feel like the reason we have the Mission Impossible movies right now is because of Mission Impossible 3, because of what J.J. Abrams did.
Mm.
Having said that, looking back at Mission Impossible 3, it's like a really expensive, but still kind of good, middling episode of Alias, which is sort of where J.J. Abrams was coming from at the time.
Well, it's funny you should say that too, because I'm pretty sure, I'm almost positive that Tom Cruise had actually watched the entire series of Alias, and he's just like, give me this guy.
Yeah. And so much of Alias was inspired by Mission Impossible, like with the team aspect and the MacGuffins and the cliffhangers and the disguises and things. And so you can see where Tom Cruise saw that and, like, you know what? This guy gets it.
Mm. Yeah, and, like, Alias, there's a great, like, B-movie TV show.
Yeah. It's funny, too, because when we get into Fallout, we'll talk about Angela Bassett, who is a CIA boss in Fallout, but she was also a CIA boss in, I think, the fourth season of Alias.
Oh, yeah, I think she may have been, yeah.
It was only a couple of episodes, but she was there. Mm-hmm. And her character in Fallout is Sloan. And, of course, who was the bad guy in Alias? It was Arvin Sloan.
Right.
And so it's kind of funny how it's still several years later.
Well, and J.J. Abrams is still a producer on the Mission Impossible series.
He is, and I think that speaks to, you know, the success of 3 that not only, you know, did it launch J.J. Abrams as a film director, but he also rejuvenated a franchise, and he's so essential to it that he's still there, even if he's still there in, like, kind of name only. But, it still has his stamp on, and I assume his stamp of approval, too, to a certain extent, that he's still kind of leading the way. I feel like at the time, I didn't think very much of 3. I didn't appreciate it for what it was, because this was like a year after, like, the couch jumping.
Oh, and yeah, I was wondering if you're gonna bring that up, because, like, yeah, I was just like, this is a low ebb for Tom Cruise,
right,
and just his life in general and his star status.
Yeah,
and the fact is, like, I think it was like a screening of this when it came out, and Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is like beating the crap out of Tom Cruise's character. People were cheering.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that. But yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman, we should say. But I feel like his villain in this is not as great as people remember, because I think a lot of what makes the villain good is how PSH played him. Like, there's not a lot of villain there on paper. Like, the villain is almost a MacGuffin himself, because Ethan Hunt needs someone to fight.
Yeah.
So it's, he's fun in it, and I think he appreciates what it takes to be the bad guy. But it's funny, having revisited this recently, that I don't think he's like the villain that he was quite billed as initially.
Yeah, like Billy Crudup, I think probably in that movie stands up a bit better.
Yeah. Well, that's the twist, that he's the,
or
that he's in with Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. Yeah, but the bright side is, this didn't, like, reset the universe, because we're going into Ghost Protocol next. And I remember seeing the trailer for Ghost Protocol, and I was like, really? We're still doing this? And it's so bizarre because I saw Ghost Protocol and I saw it in IMAX because in front of the IMAX version was the first 15 minutes of The Dark Knight Rises. And so I wanted to see those. And so I went to an IMAX screening of this. And, you know, it, you know, in order of importance of what of going to an IMAX screening, where the first priority was The Dark Knight Rises clip. And then it goes, like, obviously I paid for this movie, so I'll stick around and watch Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I experienced it in IMAX, because that is a film worthy of the IMAX treatment. The scene where he's climbing the Burj Khalifa, that's acrophobia done well.
Oh yeah, and the entire sandstorm, trying to outrun it. Yeah,
yeah. That sequence, that whole sequence, actually is so great from beginning to end. But you know, I just remember, was it last week or no, the week before we reviewed Skyscraper, and that's a movie that you'd think would, you know, promote. You know, if you have a certain dislike of heights, it would trigger you, and it really doesn't. But seeing Ghost Protocol in IMAX really, you know, gave you some vertigo at times. So this is kind of where we get into the death-defying antics of Tom Cruise when it comes to the series, because what did they do? They actually went to the Burj Khalifa, actually had Tom Cruise on a string out on the side of this building, climbing it. And I think that's what sets one of the things, going back to the series overall, is what sets these apart. Is I think when it goes too deep into, you know, visual effects and you know, the computer imagery, or when a stunt looks too fake. And this is a real plus when we get to Fallout too, is that everything feels real, everything feels authentic, everything feels like if you go up in the air, if you go on the roof, if you're going on the side of a building, do it. Obviously do it as safely as possible, but realism still has value, I think, in the cinema over, again, you know, you're making something like Skyscraper and The Rock's hanging over a green screen. It's just not the same.
I had to take a wild guess and say you didn't like Skyscraper.
No, I wasn't a fan of Skyscraper. No, it could have been better. Next time, have The Rock hang off a real skyscraper is what I'm saying, I guess. I mean, you know, he maybe... I think The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, works too much to, like, take a year to dedicate himself to training for one stunt the way Tom Cruise does. But
yeah, and I guess for Ghost Protocol, like, that, I think the entire movie, mm-hmm. I mean, the ending, it kind of loses a bit of the, the urgency, like, just the way the very last, like, sequence kind of seems.
Oh, in the parking garage.
Yeah, it seems a bit over the top, but like certainly the first like hour and a half is fantastic, and especially that entire Kremlin sequence is just is ridiculously well done.
Yeah,
and of course, I mean, the guy who directed it had only done cartoons up to that point. Of course, like, this is Brad Bird, the guy that of course is known for The Incredibles, and that entire the opening like 15-20 minutes is just phenomenal.
Yeah, the like the prison break. It goes from like this prison break to the Kremlin break-in, and then they're on their way to the Burj Khalifa, which is like the huge midsection of the film where there's so much going on, where there's like two missions going on simultaneously. Yeah. And I think one of the reasons this is probably the most cinematic of the Mission Impossible movies. Not that they aren't all cinematic, but I think this is like because it was Brad Bird and because he's used to like planning every detail. From his animation background, I think that's why this executes so well. Every scene feels like they just like massaged it till it was perfect. Like they had the step by step to how it was shot, to how it was edited, to how it was scored. It's so realized well, and you know, it speaks to my cynicism about like going to see another Mission Impossible movie, that by the end I was like, I gotta see Mission Impossible 5 now. And another thing I really appreciated about this was the team dynamic, because you know, one of the whole points of Mission Impossible is that it's not just the main star, but it's the team effort. It's everybody brings something to the mission, whether that's, you know, tech or gadgets, or whether that's being the mole, or whether that's, you know, being someone who, you know, is in the guts of a mainframe. You know, that's the whole point of it is that, you know, the mission isn't successful unless the whole team as a whole is successful and executes their part. And that's what I really liked about it. And there's also the added urgency of this is that, you know, the team is kind of thrown together. Mm-hmm. It's not Ethan Hunt choosing, you know, his, you know, the team of, you know, highly qualified specialists. It's like, well, here's Simon Pegg and here's Paula Patton. And then they throw Jeremy Renner in, who was supposed to take over.
Yeah, I thought so too.
And well, I think they came on like purposely said, like, yeah, we're gonna make this was like 2012 when they had Jeremy Renner in Avengers, and he was gonna take over for Jason Bourne, and he was gonna take over, and it's just like it was gonna be all Jeremy Renner all the time, and it's
and now he's just simply doing Hawkeye.
Or Tag, or I mean, I'm kind of glad for him because I'm not sure Jeremy Renner is as magnetic as people thought, or at least just Fred going from Hurt Locker. I understand why people saw Hurt Locker and saw a star, but you know, I think that was a very particular instance for Jeremy Renner. But yeah, it's so great, and one of the things that I think that gets highlighted later on is how that carries over into number five, which is Rogue Nation, and how it manages to say, okay, in Ghost Protocol, it feels like we finally got a back wind to this, and they carry over all these elements at work, like the death-defying on Tom Cruise's part, you know, key characters like Jeremy Renner and Simon Pegg, building, like, kind of for the first time, a kind of permanent team for these films. And then, you know, Christopher McQuarrie comes on and he pushes it even further by, you know, actually giving Ethan Hunt, well, a couple of good foils in it. First is the Sean Harris as the villain, Solomon Lane, who's running like this rogue kind of impossible missions force outfit. And then the other one is, of course, Rebecca Ferguson, who is kind of like the female Ethan Hunt, which brings something that the franchise never really had, which was a strong female lead who could be a match for Tom Cruise.
And I actually, I remember when that movie came out because I had never heard of Rebecca Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, she had very little to her credit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, like, okay, how did they come across her? And I know exactly what it was, because, or at least from what I've read, is that she had done a miniseries called The White Queen, which Tom Cruise just happened to see. Like, I don't know how he happened across this, but he just happened to have seen it and was just entranced by what she had done. And, like, I guess he more or less, like, had the authority. He's like, hey, do you want this part?
Here's this lady I saw on TV the other day. I think she'd be great at Mission Impossible. Maybe, but I mean, that's part of the fun of that is because she was a find.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you get somebody who does come out of nowhere these days and it, like, makes such an impression.
Yeah.
And she does as Ilsa, you know, from like the minute she's, you know, she steps into the film and she takes off her shoes before she's going to torture Ethan Hunt. And it's so great. And I'm glad they brought her back. And more importantly, I'm glad they didn't misuse her by bringing her back.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Fallout, that I think they managed to balance it quite well, making her like an ex officio member of the IMF team while still kind of keeping her as a foil to Tom Cruise as he's going about another mission, which we're going to talk about coming up next, our review of Mission Impossible Fallout, to get us in the mood, because we haven't set a mood already talking about Mission Impossible, but I thought we'd go with the obvious pick for music this week, and we'll let you figure that out. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
do you think you're doing, Erica?
It may be your mission, but this is the CIA's plane. It doesn't take off without my say-so.
We need reliable intelligence, and we need it now. This scenario is precisely why the IMF exists.
The IMF is Halloween, Alan. A bunch of grown men in rubber masks playing trick-or-treat. And if he had held on to the plutonium in Berlin, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
And his team would be dead.
Yes, they would. That's the job. And that's why I want one of my own men on the scene to appraise the situation. Agent Walker, Special Activities.
His reputation precedes.
You use a scalpel. I prefer a hammer. My man goes where no one goes.
Believe it. That was a clip from Mission Impossible Fallout. It's the new film from Christopher McQuarrie. And it stars Tom Cruise, Henry Cavill, Simon Pegg, Ving Rhames, Rebecca Ferguson, Michelle Moynihan, and Alec Baldwin. It's interesting to see Henry Cavill in this, playing kind of a villain. He's, I think it's funny when you're talking about Rebecca Ferguson being a foil for Tom Cruise, and she is in terms of matching Ethan Hunt in terms of skill and fighting ability and being duplicitous. Henry Cavill is, makes for an interesting match against Tom Cruise because as Angela Bassett there infers, Tom Cruise is a scalpel, Henry Cavill is a hammer, and there's, you know, the scenes in the trailer of this fight in the bathroom where see Tom Cruise getting thrown around like a paper doll, and I mean, they both get kind of beat up in that scene, but Henry Cavill gets up, off comes the jacket, and you can practically hear, like, boom, boom, like, when he flexes, it's go time. It's so much, and again, it shows, like, how charismatic and fun that Henry Cavill can be when he's allowed, which is something that's always stuck in my craw about those DC movies where he's played Superman, because Henry Cavill can clearly not be in a position where he doesn't have to brood. Like, if you watch this and you watch the man from Uncle, and then you go watch the Man of Steel movies, or the DC movies, it's hard to believe it's the same person, even though they look alike. But he's a great addition to this film, I have to admit.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, actually, Man of Steel, I think, was the first time I became aware of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and watched The Tudors. And I realized, like, wow, this guy actually is a really, really good actor.
Mm-hmm.
And those movies kind of negate that, which bothers me. And then I watched The Man from Uncle. I'm like, yeah, he can act as long as he, like, if they allow him to.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to see the fact that they actually let him let loose in this movie. Because mm-hmm. I would have been really annoyed if they're just like, oh, he's just, you know, acting like a big tough guy.
Yeah.
I would have been really annoyed.
Yeah, he's a beast in this, obviously, because he looks it. But, you know, one of my favorite scenes is he and Tom Cruise do a halo jump from a suborbital plane, but there's Tom Cruise, there's a storm. They have to basically drop through a storm. Tom Cruise is like, I don't know about this. And Henry Cavill's like, out of my way, dork. And then he ends up losing his air in that jump, and Tom Cruise makes the switch, and Tom Cruise, as a result, has a rough landing, but Henry Cavill lands fine, and he's like, oh, too little tough for you, huh, Hunt? Which is some great snark. But, I mean, that's one of the things that surprised me about this, was it's the sense of humor. There's a lot of great, like, back and forth with Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg as well, because I guess they're, like, they're both, like, equally techie, although, so they're always, like, sniping at each other, I guess, to determine who is the best Ethan Hunt sidekick. But that was a surprising little thing in that, is that, you know, the humor, the characters got to enjoy some humorous moments, even though the stakes were very, very high.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's just that I don't know. I think that was kind of missing. Yeah, that's a part that I noticed quite a bit in this movie, and I don't think I've actually seen in the previous Mission Impossible, is that, like, because they're almost morosely serious, and even when they're being funny in the previous Mission Impossibles, it was not really taken as funny. It was more or less like, oh, we're joking, but not really.
it's kind of dorky. Yeah, there's some scenes like that. I'm like in Ghost Protocol, there's one where Tom Cruise has to like basically leap down the side of the building and they have to drag him in, catch him and drag him in. And then Simon Pegg comes in because he's been busy switching the room numbers on up and down the hallway. And he's like, oh boy, did I have a time. And there's like little bits like that. But I think it's unusual because Christopher McQuarrie's come back. And this is the first time the series has had somebody come back and directed before. So I think he brings a certain, now that he's done one, he brings a certain comfort and he's able to, you know, try things out and he understands the characters a bit better and can, you know, let them rub up against each other in new and interesting ways and write more clearly to each character's voice. I admit, you know, although McQuarrie is undoubtedly talented.
Mm-hmm.
I worried about him coming back for a second one because I feel like what I was worried about was the Spectre phenomena, like how Sam Mendes came back for Spectre. And it was always going to be hard because Skyfall is like one of the best Bonds ever. So any return was going to be a come down.
Minus that Home Alone ending.
I love the Home Alone ending. James Bond Home Alone, come on. But I think that when you sign on to a James Bond movie or a Mission Impossible movie, more often than not you're signing on to one, so you tend to like dump everything you have to say into that one project, and everything you ever wanted to do you have to do it because that's your chance. And I wondered if that was what happened with Sam Mendes. He did everything he wanted to do with a James Bond movie in Skyfall. And then, you know, so Spectre was always going to come up short. I was thinking, or I was dreading, that it was going to be the same thing with Fallout. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised that it wasn't, that McQuarrie was able to take the things in Rogue Nation that worked well and were able to push them further. Mm-hmm. Like bringing back the villain again, bringing back Sean Harris as Solomon Lane. Again, you know, that could have shorted, but they managed to do something really neat with that character.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing back Rebecca Ferguson again, and, you know, what was she going to do? Like, we got to know that character fairly well, so you're going to bring her back and make her all, like, enigmatic and stuff again. But he manages to figure that out, how to manage to both balance that and, you know, make her part of the team. The death-defying antics of Tom Cruise... we get that in a couple of places. There's the Halo jump.
Yeah.
There's hanging from a helicopter. And, you know, and we're at a point in the series where you're like, anytime you see Ethan Hunt undertake something, you're like, well, is there anything he can't do? And then at the end, there's a helicopter chase, and you find out Ethan Hunt can't fly a helicopter, so he's making it up as he goes.
Well, also that the ridiculous tech situation that Simon Pegg's character has, where he doesn't realize like the shape of the building, and Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt jumps off the roof. Tom Cruise actually like almost shattered his ankle while he did that.
Yeah, that's right.
And it delayed production for almost 2 months.
Yeah, that it's funny that was like just jumping from one roof to another, which is fairly ordinary stunt, almost did him in. But the Halo jump and hanging from helicopters and airplanes taking off and tall buildings, that's fine. That all goes according to plan. But it's, you know, there's so much to, I think, enjoy in this film. And I think it's 2.5 hours long, which I think is the longest.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel it.
No, it doesn't. And like I jokingly said to a few people when I told them that I saw this, I'm like, the movie is basically just one long action sequence, because there really isn't a lot of dull or like even slow moving parts in this movie.
No,
and even the one like I'm trying to think what the setting was when he's trying to determine I think it was the person they fight in the bathroom.
Oh, right.
Yeah, like where he goes to that where they both where Ethan's character and the character that Henry Cavill plays.
Mm-hmm.
They both go to that place. Like that has a very like it's a slow moving scene, but it's phenomenally shot. I'm like, wow, I don't think Mission Impossible has ever had a sequence like that. I'm like, this had a bit of a mystery and aura to it
right.
that you didn't see in any of the Mission Impossible before that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, that, because it's Mission Impossible, the mission has to, sound impossible. They have, 20 minutes to get in, find this person, duplicate them, poses them, go into this other party, get this information they need, and get out again, all without hoping anyone would notice. But I do love that scene, too, because it introduces us to the White Widow,
right,
played by Vanessa Kirby, and it's strongly implied that she is the daughter of Vanessa Redgrave's character
in the first film.
And that connection is so much fun because the way Vanessa Kirby plays it, I was wondering if she was Vanessa Redgrave's daughter, but it turns out she isn't. But in terms of the mannerisms and the way she, sort of loves having Tom Cruise show up and screw things up, and adding to her a little bit of mischievous flair to her life, and I enjoyed her character a lot, and I thought she was a fun addition. Just everybody in the film I think is really good, and whether they're returning, whether the new Alec Baldwin, having him back as the IMF boss, it was, that's a lot of fun because it was kind of hard to take Alec Baldwin seriously in Rogue Nation. Cause it was there was a lot of Jack Donaghy in his 30 Rock character and the way he was playing Huntley in Rogue Nation. You have to expect a Tina Fey to show up and go, wow, what a week, huh? Lemon, it's Wednesday. I guess he's so tied to that comedic aspect of his persona now, he can't really whip out the shadow voice and be foreboding like he used to be. But, it works here.
But would anybody want him to whip out the shadow voice?
I kind of like the shadow. It's a guilty pleasure. But, yeah, it's funny to just watch I like this about the Fast and the Furious movies too, but just to watch something evolve organically, that having somebody turn up here because they were implanted in part two or part three and now it's paying off, but to watch a series grow organically is very, very rewarding. To be able to watch these movies over six movies go from where they were to where they are now, and to see each person come on in their own way and bring something new and unique, it would make me sad if this was the last one, but I wonder what the thought process is behind that, because it seems to put a button on the series in the end. It feels it could end here, but it could also go on.
Yeah, I actually got that impression too. With the ending in and of itself, it seemed like it was almost, and I mean almost, a clean ending, as in it's just okay, we're done, we're gonna pause, we'll see if this movie makes any money, will we make another? That's the impression I got. But I guess when you're saying bringing back characters and having them evolve, I was a little hesitant to see why they would bring back Michelle Moynihan's character.
Right.
But I love the fact that they did, and I love the way they brought her back. I thought that was fantastic.
Because that's always there in the back of your mind. He at the end of part three, he goes off and has this happy life, and he's happily ever after. And then you come back in point four, it's is she dead? What happened? And, I like that, too, that there's a pointed scene in the end where she basically tells him like he doesn't have to be guilty for dragging her into the spy world and making her have to go into witness protection or whatever she was doing, and that that she's found her own calling, she's on her own journey, she's married to Wes Bentley, and I just want to pause here and talk about what the heck happened to Wes Bentley. He used to be the next big thing, and now he's 12th fiddle in Mission Impossible 6.
I can tell you. Probably a lot of drugs.
All right.
I think that's probably what it is. Like, he was in a lot of movies, and I think it was just, like, substance abuse problems and things like that, I would imagine.
Well, that's a shame. But, I mean, still, I mean, I'm glad people are throwing him a bone, but...
Well, he was in all the Hunger Games movies.
Was he in all of them, or was he just in the one?
He was in a few, I think. And he's shown up in a few movies in the past few years. But yeah, up until the past like 5 years or so, he hadn't done much.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, putting Wes Bentley aside, but she makes the point of saying that, you know, she is fine, her life is fine. He didn't mess her up, or mess up her life. It just took a turn, and she found something else. I like how they did that, but what I like more is, as you said, they didn't fridge her, which would have been the quickest, easiest way to deal with the dangling wife problem, because it's hard to run off and save the world and climb helicopters and all the rest when you've got someone at home waiting for you to come home for dinner or for, you know, for weekend plans or the in-laws or whatever. It seems so, and this is the thing that still ticks me off about Deadpool 2, even like 2 months later. It's just like, you know, to the only way to motivate a male character is to kill the girlfriend or to kill the wife. And Mission Impossible has been really, really great about, you know, it hasn't always, you know, made females the main protagonist or you know, an equal part of the story to Ethan Hunt. But they've been very, very smart in the way that in the treatment of women. You know, Michelle Moynihan doesn't get fridged. Like, as we've seen in past movies, I think Paula Patton did, and I know Rebecca Ferguson did it in past movies, where they're, like, walking around in high heels. But before they spring to action, the heels come off. And it's you know, that it's really great in those sequences. It's like, these ridiculous shoes off, because obviously they're of no use in any practical situation. And I think that has one of the things that has made the series a little bit smarter than the average.
Well, and not only that, I think it was actually very, very clever, is the one sequence with Michelle Monaghan, is she's interacting with Ving Rhames' character in the movie, and just the way she's interacting with him, you can tell, oh, they really, really know each other.
Yeah.
And she's just like, how is he? Like, really? Should I be concerned about him? And he's just like, oh, no.
Yeah.
He's the same old.
Same old, same old. Look, he's there dangling from a helicopter. But yeah, there are a lot of great callbacks to that, and I did like that too. And I like I like when Ilsa Faust gets a look at, like, Ethan's, like, internal, you know, reaction mode, when he just, like, hangs off a helicopter and she's like, what the hell is he doing? Like, fully understanding the insanity of Ethan Hunt for the first time. But I think you're right. This is kind of a nonstop action. But it's also smartly done too, because there were, like, sequences where you see things happen, and I don't want to spoil much, because I think it works when you kind of get surprised, but you see, like, scenarios play themselves and you're thinking, oh no, this is bad. But then there's a twist, and it's like, they're playing somebody, and they manage to convince you as an audience member to go along with it. And I think that's what's really fun about movies like this, is when you know, in the back of your head, you're not super analyzing everything, and you buy everything, and then they deliver the twist, and it turns out that the movie is a little bit smarter than you.
Yeah,
I enjoy when that happens.
Yeah, especially with the
Cavill. Skyscraper a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, like, well, that's what I was thinking with Henry Cavill's character. I thought that was the twist there was really clever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although. Anyway, I wasn't sure I completely, I mean, because the character is introduced as being somewhat morally ambiguous. Yeah, so.
Well, I mean, he's a spy. Well, they all are.
Right. But, you know, he's, as we played in a clip, he's introduced as, like, one of the, like, the CIA kill squad goons, right, who's being, like, attached to Ethan Hunt, because Ethan can't be entirely trusted to, you know, put... dead bodies in the ground over over saving, you know, a friend, and we see that play out again later. That whole sequence in Paris was fun too.
Oh, absolutely. And the car chase sequence under the train, I'm like, French Connection.
That's right. It's funny too, because I'm curious how they got away with that, because from what I understand, like, after the Paris attacks in 2016, I thought, like, they weren't allowing any more action stuff to be shot in Paris.
Oh, really?
But maybe they've chilled out on that by the time Mission Impossible came calling, or maybe it was, you know, Tom Cruise's star power. But
yeah, because, I mean, what most people probably don't realize is that, believe it or not, the French absolutely love American movie stars. They do. They absolutely do.
That's what Cannes based on. Yeah. Just 2 weeks of American movie stars coming to the south of France. It hasn't gotten talked about much, but I did want to approach the delicate subject of Tom Cruise's personal life, the Scientology thing, because I did read an article where it was talking about how he was doing press, and nobody's kind of bringing up Scientology, which is kind of a hot topic right now. When you think about like Going Clear, and you think about Leah Remini
and Paul Haggis, can go, the guy who played Hyde from that 70s show is a Scientologist.
Danny Masterson,
too,
and
even Beck, of all people.
Beck. But I mean, there seems to be two people who seem to be able to skate on it. One is Tom Cruise, the other is Elizabeth Moss.
Who's John Travolta, I think?
Well, John Travolta doesn't do much anymore. But I mean, just in terms of like high profileness, like, I think Tom Cruise even moved to Florida to be near to the Florida's where David Miscavige lives, who's the head of Scientology and probably its most controversial figure. And, you know, you want to learn how, Google David Miscavige's wife. I wonder how, because I know one member of our crew has ambiguous feelings about Tom Cruise. Mm. And I understand them. But it seems that, we're here in the Me Too era, where we kind of throw anyone under the bus who steps a lot out of line. But Tom Cruise seems to kind of skate, and I wonder, you know, why that is. Is it because he's kind of like one of the last big movie stars? So, you know, is it the natural Cruise charisma?
I'm trying to understand exactly how you're framing that. Is it because of Scientology, or?
Well, just because the Scientology, all the negatives and all the, he should get beat up by that more.
Yeah.
One would think, but he seems to get away with not having to address it ever.
That is a good question, and I'm wondering why that actually is. It's just like, maybe people look past that with him, and to a certain degree, because I know he does catch flack. Like, for instance, Valkyrie, I believe he did catch, because the man that he's playing was a real guy, and it was real,
and a hero,
and a real instance. And it was, I think it was his grandson said, like, oh, I don't have anything to do with this, and he didn't have anything against Tom Cruise, he had it against him because he was a Scientologist. Because
Scientology is a cult in Germany.
Yeah.
They don't have religious status.
And in all honesty, they've been, like, I mean, this is how well disliked Scientology is. In most of the Western world, they've been investigated by every single Justice Department, and I believe including our own.
Mm-hmm. It's just curious. It's just an element of curiosity to me, you know, that we don't really talk about it that much. Although, it was a factor back during the Mission Impossible 3 phase.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You
know, it seems that, things change.
I think maybe it's a marketing thing in the fact that when he's promoting a movie, he's just like realizes, okay, we're promoting a product here. Maybe he tries to steer clear of discussing Scientology when
any
he's
personal stuff for that matter.
Or any personal stuff.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I don't think he's alone in interviews as well, because I've seen actors getting sandbagged for ridiculous things when they're, like, promoting something else. I mean, the one instance I could think of, and this is why Rosie O'Donnell lost her talk show when she sandbagged Tom Selleck about guns.
Right.
And she lost her job because of that interview.
Mm-hmm.
And an interviewer had asked Robert Downey Jr. about his substance abuse past.
Right.
And he literally got disgusted and walked out of the interview.
You know, but that's a good news story. I mean, it should be a good thing that he overcame those.
Yeah.
Those
absolutely. Because
I remember when he was in and out of rehab, and everybody, you know, that was like the last straw. Like, nobody wanted to touch him.
Yeah, and I remember watching him in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and I was just like, there's a good actor.
Yeah.
Like, why isn't this guy working? I mean, yeah, he has these issues, but you know what? He can act, and he's watchable. And Iron Man has proven everybody wrong.
Iron Man, yeah, because I was because it was the 10th anniversary of that recently. That it was such a gamble.
Yeah,
when he was cast as Iron Man, and that's a gamble that's paid off.
Yeah, I know.
Again.
Yeah, I know. Like, everybody should be like falling on John Favreau's feet. Just like, oh, we were all wrong. We were all wrong.
John Favreau should get a muffin basket from Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I know.
He's on the anniversary of his Iron Man casting. Anyway, we'll have to leave that there. Go see Mission Impossible Fallout because we both liked it. You can watch, or you can listen, I should say. Listen to this episode again at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can find us on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Jesse, where can people find more of you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Jesse Malott, and I'm on Facebook.
And I am also on Twitter. You can find me at Adam A. Donaldson. And you can also find me there on Instagram, too, at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find me tomorrow at 5 p.m. on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And that's for news and politics. And again, that's Thursday at 5 p.m. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more Open Sources. And we'll see you then.